said, my old said, came to welcome me with the classical wish, Alan was Alan. It is not surprising that he has remained in our family's service for 25 years. It was something else that surprised me. I had known him to be quarrelsome, vindictive, brutal, a women chaser, and an incorrigible drinker. Today he is gentle, patient, and humble. He does not raise his voice. His gestures are sober and deliberate. A certain indefinable and inexpressible serenity emanates from him. To clear up the mystery, I questioned said a few days later, as our long friendship allowed. He answered, God willed it. God willed that. That was all. He didn't explain. Said knows my religion and sincerely respects it, but he will not let me penetrate into his inner life. Not content with such an evasive explanation, I went to his home one morning. He lives in the heart of the Arab quarter, in one of those houses with whitewashed walls. He lives with his wife Zara and the abandoned child he adopted. It is a strange oasis of peace and order, contrasting with the hubbub of the neighborhood. It was 8 o'clock. I went to said's room but, contrary to the laws of Oriental hospitality, he made no effort to welcome me. He was at prayer. I later discovered that said did not limit himself to the 5 daily ritual prayers, but spent considerable time in prayer or meditation besides. Was this his secret? The explanation of his transformation? While I waited for said, I was told that he begins to pray every day at dawn, and then goes out to work until mid-afternoon. Once back home, he resumes his prayer. During this time the whole household keeps silence. Only afterward does the coming and going of visitors begin. Said is known in his neighborhood, and his neighbors come to ask his advice. He settles the myriad daily quarrels that are submitted to his arbitration. He does not allow anyone to publicly give him the title of sheikh to which he has a right. However, he is unanimously respected, and is surrounded with more attentions than a venerable marabout. He is always ready to chat, and his words are filled with a wisdom and gentleness that amaze anyone who knew the said of earlier days. At night he prays again at length before going to sleep. He spends not less than 5 hours with his God during the course of a day. When said had finished praying he came to me, invited me into a tiny drawing room, and offered me the traditional cup of coffee. In a word, he received me with all the refinements of exquisite Oriental hospitality. After leaving him, I returned homeward slowly. It was my turn to meditate. Do you understand why I wanted you to read this letter? It clearly shows that said's prayer life is the source of the transformation of his character and of his moral life, and not the reverse. My friend made no mistake about it. I grant you that self-mastery is necessary to anyone who wants to progress in mental prayer. But prayer is even more necessary in order to arrive at self-mastery. Indeed, I greatly fear that if you wait until you have acquired self-mastery before you devote yourself to mental prayer, you may never succeed in either. Anyway, the expression self-mastery that you use seems open to debate. A Christian has better things to do than to aspire to self-mastery. He should rather be striving to let God have mastery over him. Consider said. Do you think that if he had merely attained self-mastery, he would have had this magnetic influence on those around him? Through his transformed and pacified personality, the presence of another within him shone forth and attracted. See God. Surrender your spirit to the growing dominion of his love, and you will soon discover that order and peace will take root within you. Saint Augustine vigorously and clearly expresses this great law of the spiritual life. It is fitting that the inferior be subject to the superior. He who wants to dominate what is inferior to himself, must submit to what is superior to himself. Your own submission is to God, and the flesh and all its inclinations, must submit to you. What could be more just? What could be more beautiful? You are subject to what is greater than you. If you break the first law, you owe submission to God, then the second law will never be carried out, the flesh owes submission to you. There is a privileged means for achieving the submission to God of our whole being. It is mental prayer. Said bears witness to it, as have countless Christians over the centuries. 93. You will see my back X33:23. Your letter brought to mind a woman of lowly estate whom I encountered over 30 years ago. As a young priest, I was then living with a colleague who had rented me a room near the Basilica of Montmartre. A woman from the neighborhood came to do the housework, and I sometimes chatted with her while she was sweeping my room. She seemed very old to me. Today I would have quite a different idea of her age. She was tiny, nimble, discreet as a shadow, and seemed always to be apologizing for existing. She was certainly very virtuous, I should say very holy. But to realize it, one had to take a close look at her eyes. They were the only chink into her interior world, from which shone an intense and pure light. She would pray for hours at the basilica on her knees, her eyes fixed on the monstrance. It was whispered about that she gave half of her meager salary to others poorer than herself. I had to give you this brief description, so you could grasp the significance of the dialogue I am going to relate to you. It is at once elliptic and very rich in spiritual meaning. One day, when I was preparing to preach a retreat, I said to her, "Pray that I may be able to speak well to them about God." And she answered, almost inadvertently, "Oh. Above all, don't talk about God." Then, embarrassed by what she had just said, she apologized, "I'm really stupid. I don't know why I said that to you." And I couldn't get her to say another word. In any event, I was greatly intrigued by her curious little statement, spoken with so much conviction. It was probably from that moment that I took an interest in her spiritual life. Something else she said, after hearing a sermon, enabled me to grasp her thinking a little better. She confided, "I was so happy. The preacher said that we cannot understand God. But don't you have a great desire to know God?" "Yes, but not to understand him. It's always when I think that we can't understand anything about God, that I feel as if I'm surrounded by a very calm light." Was I wrong in surmising that you would find the answer to your questions in these words spoken by a very simple woman? Unless we stop trying to know God by our own means, we shall never really come close to him. We must not only go beyond the knowledge of the senses, but also beyond rational knowledge. Many prayerful souls are stymied in their search for God, because they are not willing to mortify their imagination and sensibility. They limit themselves to intellectual notions of God, not realizing that God will not let us grasp him through our concepts, any more than the ocean allows itself to be caught in the fishermen's nets. This humble woman knew that beautiful ideas can at best carry us only a short distance on the road to God, but that when we cling to them they prevent us from penetrating the mystery of God. She was saying in her own way what Bossuet said in more eloquent, if not more insightful, terms concerning God's sublime incomprehensibility. The further we advance in our knowledge of God, the more we see, as it were, that we know nothing worthy of him, and rising above all that we have ever thought about God or that we can ever think of God throughout eternity, we praise him in his incomprehensible truth and are lost in this praise. We must give up, once and for all, the hope of knowing God here below as he really is. Then God can infuse into the center of our soul a knowledge of himself that is both the luminous certitude of his existence and presence, as well as the complete ignorance of what he is in himself. It amounts to seeing God's back, the way Moses did. "When my glory passes, I will set you in the hollow of the rock and will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand, so that you may see my back, but my face is not to be seen. X 33:22-23. While we remain on earth, we cannot contemplate God's face. Saint Thomas Aquinas has written a deeply penetrating commentary on this subject. When we have reached the limit of our knowledge, we know God as unknown. And our intellect attains in a very perfect manner to the knowledge of God, at the precise moment it knows that the divine essence exceeds everything it can grasp in the present state of life. One of the best proofs of the presence and action within us of the gift of wisdom, the most sublime gift of the Holy Spirit, is our love for the incomprehensibility of God. We rejoice in hearing others speak of it, and dread to hear statements that claim to reveal God to us. Likewise, we feel a need during prayer to allow ourselves to be engulfed in the abyss of divine incomprehensibility, the way a pearl fisher dives into translucid waters. Before we reach this stage, however, we must spend a long time seeking the discursive presence of God by meditating on His Word, and by contemplating His attributes as they are mirrored in His creatures. It would be presumptuous to want to advance at a faster pace than God's grace does. Yearn with all your might to know God. Seek Him. Abandon yourself totally to Him so that He may lead you into this realm, infinitely beyond anything our human faculties of knowledge can explore. Meanwhile, remain very poor and small, and He will reveal Himself to be very great indeed. Love His darkness, and He will welcome you into His light. On one occasion Jesus spoke thus, "Father, Lord of heaven and earth, to you I offer praise, for what you have hidden from the learned and the clever you have revealed to the merest children. Father, it is true. You have graciously willed it so." Mount 11:25-26. 94. The mental prayer of the woman of the people. If this woman of the people heard me speak of her method of mental prayer, she would smile that serene and timid smile that was characteristic of her. And she would be right. I could even imagine a nuance of gentle irony in her smile. How poor we are, for all our wealth of technology and methods. This woman didn't have a method of prayer, any more than she had a method of smiling. She came to 7 o'clock Mass almost every morning. When I distributed Holy Communion, she stood out from the others by the quality of her recollection. Indeed, it is impossible to define this quality. She seemed to experience something so delightful, deep within her, that a mysterious radiance emanated from within and made her face flush. I was also impressed by her recollection when she knelt in the chapel, head held high and hands joined. One day as we chatted, I took the liberty of asking her how she prayed. At first she seemed surprised. But since for her a priest's question was something to be taken seriously, she reflected for a moment and answered, "At the start of my mental prayer I think of the fact that God has His own ideas, and wants something from this moment that I have come to spend with Him. Then I want what He wants, and seek no further. That's my whole prayer." Well, I can tell you that this is a very authentic, sublime and perfect kind of mental prayer. If you reflect on the modest words you have just read, you will find that they contain the highest virtues in a very exceptional degree: faith, abnegation, surrender and love. There is faith in the living God who is fully attentive to His child, and who will certainly make this mental prayer serve the intentions of His glory. Abnegation: there is no self-seeking or self-oriented desire here, not even the most purified desire. Adherence to God's will is certainly sufficiently present in her prayer. For her, it is a surrender to whatever the Lord will do, an unconditional acceptance of everything He will ask. And finally, love is present. It is a love close to adoration, and consists in yielding all the room within us to the God whom we love. On another occasion, she confided to me how she had arrived at this form of mental prayer. I'm sorry that I can't reproduce the exact words she used, because hers was the simple, down-to-earth speech of a woman of the people. But here is the substance of what she said. I went through a very painful phase.